Silver Standard Mine?
The Silver Standard Mine. Yeah, this Red Rose worked for many years to... what ore was it that they were doing? Tungsten for one. I think tungsten. There were about 3-4 different kinds of ore there. That was needed by the war. This is why they reopened that mine. And Silver Standard, of course, there's quite a bit of silver there. Of course, there were other ore in it too, eh?
Yeah.
That was in full operation when we used to go up there. Because old man Tate had many friends up there. You know that we won't write that down. The wrong kind of friends that likes to drink. Anyways, we made a lot of friends up there. There were a lot of nice people up there. There were a lot of local people worked up here, up there too. I think the Spooners worked up there too. My son Herbie worked up there too. What do you call it? Where he worked. Anyway, he worked up there too. And that was in operation until it was quite late too, in the late years, eh? And this is where a lot of these new town people had come into town to work at Silver Standard. And where, you know, they just about raised their families here because of that mine, eh? Eventually a lot of them lived at 2 Mile. Yeah, I don't remember any from Hazleton. A lot from 2 Mile had worked up there. But majority of them were from the outsiders, like the, you know, the Bennetts and them, Mrs. Phillips's family. All these people that my children went to school with were all, you know, raised from mining families, really. A lot of these people were from out of town and made a home in Newtown, eh? But my gosh, when we came back this time, I realized that a lot of those people have left, gone, or had been deceased, eh?
Yeah. And did your mother or talk about maybe the paddle wheelers that used to come up the Skeena River there?
The what?
The paddle wheelers that came up the Skeena River.
The paddle wheelers. The last time they took my own granny, Junior, I never seen her, eh?
Mm-hmm.
My own granny got sick because my grandpa Joseph had left her for a younger woman from Morristown, and they had to take away my granny to go for treatment down south. And Mrs. George and my great-granny and a few other women all went down when the boat had come in. They all went down to put my granny on the boat, eh? They took her away down south. And and they had put her in Essendale, and she got better in no time. She had nervous breakdown, eh? Because she missed Grandpa so much, and she wasn't down for too long. That two people from Morristown went down there to see her. See, no money those days. They poor. Everybody was poor. August Pete and what's his name? There's two of them went down south anyway to see her. August Pete and Alec Tildew. Yeah, Alec Tildew. Both of them went to see her, and she told them she was all better, but she has no way of getting back. She had no money. She had to ask the hospital authorities to help her to come home, and they won't. So they made her work in the hospital at Riverview. Eh?
Uh-huh.
She was doing housekeeping work, and while she was hanging clothes, those days there's no such thing as dryers. She was hanging clothes outside on the high line. She pulled it a little too hard. She fell off the veranda and busted her head open on a cement form. Yeah. And when this happened, they never told my great granny about it at all. Until 8 years later, when the Indian agent was leaving down here, Mr. Loring was his name. Connie Cox went in there to go through all the papers, is when she found this letter that came from Riverview that my granny had got killed. And they just buried her down there, never invited anyone to come down, nothing. And around wartime, just before the war broke out, I went down to Essendale to probe into this. They won't tell me anything, eh? They won't even say where she's buried. So we looked all over ourselves, eh? But this is what they used to do to the native people those days. A lot of people told me, oh, they must just say, oh, you know, they're just Indians, why should we bother, you know? So anyway, this is what they had done. And they apparently used to do that to quite a number of Indians those days. When, you know, something happens to them down there, they just keep it undercover, like, just keep it secret, like. So that was the last time the paddle wheeler went back down the river. Is when my great granny was on it. Those days, well, apparently, you know, my grandpa had left my granny for that younger woman in Morristown. She was a relative of David Dennis. I think his sister-in-law, younger one. But that didn't last. She left Grandpa too. That's, you know, things like that happens every day. But me myself, I've never seen the paddle wheeler. It's my mother and great granny and all the little kids, and Mrs. George went down to see her off. Apparently Mrs. George had suggested for her to use an Indian doctor, which used to work very good in those days, eh? She said not to send her down there because you might never see her again. And she warned them, you know, you can't trust the white people. But they still sent her down, eh? Those days they used to force the Indians to go down, eh? Just force them to go to any hospital, whether, you know, they liked it or not. So that's what they did to her. So I never seen my own granny like that. They used to have these Indian doctors that used to look after people like that. I've seen it myself. It was done by our Indian doctors over the village. They used to go past Mrs. Ting's house, way down there, because they were scared of the authorities, eh? Mm-hmm. They had banned it by then. And as little kids, I was about 8 years old when I last saw this. We all went down there to see this man that just came in from Babine. You know, to us, to look at that man, he looked quite all right. He didn't even look sick, but they said he was mentally sick. I seen him as I ran across from the school in Hagelgate to run into Jenkins's house, Peter Williams's grandpa, his dad's dad, eh? They used to call him Jenkins, and us people, we used to call him Jiggins, eh? Jiggins. I guess that's how the old people, you know, translate that Jenkins into Jiggins. I ran in there, and there was that man standing there. To me, he didn't look sick, eh? But that night, all the Indian doctors all gathered, and they were so scared of the authorities, they sneaked down one by one, you know, to perform over this man. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it done. And that mentally sick man, they worked on him for something like a couple of weeks, and that man got all better and went back to Babine, and he died of old age, not of mental problem. No, they did remarkable things, the Indian doctors. They knew just what to do. And that's the last time I've seen the Indian doctors performing. After that, they watched them a little too close. And someone was saying that maybe there was someone in the village, you know, that might have said something about it, and they got wise to it, eh? Sometimes we say things without thinking, and they figure that's what happened. Like it, as many people I've seen that they worked on, who got all better, didn't even have to go to a doctor. Like,
like my dad was telling me the stories about how the church down here at Hagelgate, how it was built, how it came about. About something like that.
The church. My great granny had a husband whose name was Bill Cook. Is all I know him of, eh? Bill Cook. He apparently was a very smart man, very bright man. My mother told me about when they were living in Morristown, eh? He used to go down to the canyon to do his fishing, like. And the white people, you know, had come along by then. White people would come up to him and try to shove him a dollar bill to buy a salmon off him. He wouldn't hear of it. I'm not here to sell this, he says. If you want it, you can have it. You can have how many you want, it's up to you. This fish is not for sale, he used to tell them. After all, you know, the Lord made it for all of us to eat it, for all of us to share it. But if you'd like, you know, to give me something, I'll leave that entirely up to you. You want to give me little tobacco, you know, chewing tobacco, mm-hmm. I'll leave it entirely up to you, is what he used to say to them. He'd use psychology on people. Uh-huh. He was so smart. Eh? Leonard George knows about him too. Eh? So when they came to Hagelgit, he was one of the people that started to help to build that church. Eh? Was it around 1910 or?
Yeah, somebody
was about to say that. Well, that picture must have been taken around 1911 or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it took them quite a while to build it, eh?
Yeah.
All by hand, eh? There was no such thing as machinery those days. Everything was done by hand. You know, I forgot what priest was here those days. It's way before Father Godfrey. Those were the days. I'm sure it was 1909 or 1910. I think it was 1909 when they actually started. It took them a long time to build.
Yeah, it took quite a while to get it. Because they had, my dad said, well, he heard from Johnny David, I guess Johnny David.
Yeah.
And it was like,
up in years, even when I was a little one, like, he was quite up there. And he was the chief of the village and the church too, like, my Grandpa Joseph, he was the chief of the church too.
And could you remember the bridge down here at the one from Anderson Oil Mission Flats to Kassan there?
Oh, you mean the one that washed out?
Yeah.
Oh, that's just about new, eh? When it washed out, what did happen? There was a big log jam and they were trying to blast that away, and that's how they blasted part of the bridge, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
And eventually got washed out, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But the one before that, I don't remember. I remember... I just remember that last one, and I remember before it was even built, because there used to be two boatmen, eh? Mm-hmm. And my great granny had only four children, and one of her daughters got drowned above Morristown, eh?
Oh, yeah.
On a Sunday, they said. They all used to dress up nice for Sunday. after they went to church, Alec Tilju and his wife those days went along with those two young girls. They're all riding horseback. No such thing as cars those days. So she was only 18 years old, this great-granny's daughter. They decided they're taking these young girls on a horseback, so they had three horses. These two young girls were on one horseback. So they went across Morristown there, and they were crossing a creek, a good-sized creek that was swollen. So they're going across that creek by horses, and as the horses was trying to jump up on the bank, the horse slipped, and the young girl in the back got thrown off like and into the swollen creek. And the last time they saw her still trying to swim at Morristown Canyon, before she went down to the fierce rapids, like they saw her still trying to swim. And that's the last time they saw her right there. You know, people that were at the canyon saw her. So for a whole month, they said, great-granny used to come crying down the river from Morristown, you know, down this way, like looking. Her and her husband looking, and some friends of theirs. All of a sudden, they used to have a canoe that used to go back and forth before that bridge was ever built in Hazleton, eh? So these two men, one of them happened to look up, up the river, and he says to his partner, "I see something very shiny coming down," he says to him. "You better be prepared, it may be that girl, you know." So sure enough, it was her. She was, you know, all dressed up. She had gold earrings on. That's what was shining. So she floated down to where they were. It took just about a month. She floated down to them, and they picked her up and took her across the river and then back to where she belonged, like Morristown. So that was quite a while before even the bridge was built, that they had found this girl and took her back to Morristown and had her buried. That great-granny had all her children all die from her. The other son got drowned fishing in Babine. See, they used to have relatives that got married all over Babine area too. There weren't very many in that family at all, but there was one of them got married to one of great-granny's brothers. So they used to go visit all around, during the summertime, so that's what happened. One of great-granny's sons was fishing at Babine in like on the lake, and they didn't say it was a gaff hook. In some sort of manner he was fishing and he fell into the lake and hit a rock in the bottom. He got killed. That's the one boy. And another one got kicked in the spleen at 2 Mile. In the old days, they used to have a tavern in 2 Mile. And this one man got all drunked up, and he went and, just because this young man happened to look at his wife, you know, maybe smiled at her, is what I heard. And he got jealous and he kicked that young man, and that's how he died. you say 2 Mile used to be a wild place one time. Yeah, I think she had only 3 children. They all died in that manner. Great granny's children. So, great granny, you know, after she lost all her family, then she ended up with my mother, and my mother. And Dan and Leon and Auntie Agnes, she ended up looking after them, you know. Mm-hmm. She raised them up too. And when they grew up, then she ended up helping to raise me and Walter too. So that's 3 generations in a family that great granny had mothered. Yeah, this is how, you know, the native people used to work at those days. Whoever, you know, is the oldest would look after whoever comes along. Like, you know, I heard sometimes there's 4 generations that the older people would look after, help to care for in every manner, like.
Do you remember who my mother and father, their father, like, what their name, and, well, it's Joe and...
Joe Wilson.
Joe Wilson, yeah.
Your mom's dad was, but, you know, I don't remember their Indian names. Joe and Maggie.
Joe and Maggie.
Yeah, Maggie was our tribe of people, eh?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, even though she's married into the Wilsons, she used to come and sneak to my mother and tell her everything, you know, what was going on, little news, like. Yeah, Maggie, yeah. I remember them the first time they were living below the hospital.
Oh, yeah.
We used to stop off there to visit Maggie. I remember that. That's your granny. And he had a great big house just below the hospital, down where the gate used to be. Just below there, around the curve there, is where they used to live. And eventually moved up to Haggett, where those boys live now. When they were living up there, those days we used to live just below them. There's a little log house that Mrs. Thomas George's mother gave us. Where we used to live those days. I remember my mother added another room to it herself, like, with Dan's help. This is where we were very close those days, because we were just below them.
Mm-hmm.
And they figured it was much closer to the water hole too, eh? Those days, we used to haul a lot of water by hands. The water hole used to be just this side of Sebastian.
Mm-hmm.
And it all had to be carried by hand.
Yeah.
We used to figure it was great to go pack water for the teacher, Mr. Browning. See, the teacher we had those days was an Englishman, Mr. Browning, and his wife, who we used to call we used to call her the lady teacher, Mrs. Browning. And they had one daughter. She was a teenager when we were young, very young. And the lady teacher used to go home just before lunch to make us a big pot of soup. And she used to bring down a big box of pilot bread. That was our lunch, eh? They did that on their own, like, eh? They were good enough. I guess they felt sorry for us because, you know, most of our houses didn't have very much, like, in line of food. As I say, there's no such thing as welfare those days. So we used to have a nice lunch at the school, and after school we'd rush up to their teacherage. That's where your mom and dad lived for a while, when your mom looked after welfare kids. And we'd run up to the teacherage and grab those big 4-gallon cans, go pack water for them, just to get cocoa and a piece of pie and, you know, sandwich or whatever. Oh, they looked after us very good. They were good people. They were both Catholics too, so Mrs. Browning taught us all how to knit, crochet, and sew. And we used to do all that all the year round, like, prepare for Christmas, like. And when there was a Christmas tree comes along, my God, we used to get all kinds of goodies and mitts to wear, or little hats to use, or little dresses. We used to do all that. She taught all the girls handicraft, and and Mr. Browning taught the boys how to make different things, you know, in line of carpentry or different things, you know, to the boys, like, so. They were the greatest couple, I think, family we've ever had in that village, because they did so much for us Native kids, like. They were understanding. And Mr. Browning used to try to help, you know, who is really in need. He used to write letters for them to take to the Indian agent, where we used to get, like, not directly to the kids, eh? The parents somehow, they give you a little help, like. I don't know, they used to get salt salmon that used to come in from the coast, and they used to hand that out, like, you know. As I say, there's no such thing as $165 a month those days. Yeah. Just the old people over 65 got $3 a month, and all they could get was 24 pound of flour, 5 pound of bag of sugar, and 1 pound of tea and 1 pound of lard. And if there's little extra, it wasn't very much. But with $3, you can buy a lot those days compared to now. And I think because the Native people are very, very smart, handy people, eh? They put up so much themselves, you know. They put up their meats of every kind, many types of meats, starting from moose. Those days we used to have quite a bit of caribou around this country. Caribou, and then deer. Meat, and then the in the mountains, when they go up for huckleberries, they bring back groundhog or goat meat of different types. They used to put up so much, and then fish of every kind, you know. A lot of berries that is put away, you know, by dehydration. They preserve many types of food in that manner. And, you know, they used to have these big cedar boxes which they used to preserve meats of every kind, berries of every kind that they dry during the late fall. These boxes were made of cedar. They were in bent box form, eh? Mm-hmm. And they used to put that all away and dig into the ground very deep and put it away till spring comes. Then they take it out and use it then. They don't use it before that. Everything is preserved and put away till then. Our people used to be very, very smart people, like self-reliant, like. But you know, the way I see ourselves now, we're sure spoiled a lot by the white people, eh? We are very spoiled. We depend on the supermarkets a little too much. Maybe this is why, you know, there's something wrong with some of us. Too much of white man's food and too much of added food preservatives.
Any story about the war, World War II? Your brother, was that Herbie, your brother? Herbie?
My son.
Oh, your son, yeah, that's right. He was in the, he joined the army.
My Herbie was in the army, yeah. Well, old man, my ex, old man Herb Tate was in the army.
Oh, yeah.
He was in the army, but he didn't go overseas. Eh?
Oh, yeah.
You ever had a chat with Tommy Tate? Tommy's been drinking too much, I guess. He doesn't talk about it now?
No.
He was in the army, and old man Tate was, and young Herbie, and they were in the army. The only one that went overseas is Tommy Tate. Tommy Tate, he's been all over, eh? And old man Herb, I don't really think he wanted to go overseas, eh? But Tommy's been all over and he's seen a lot, eh? Someone said, you know, he's not fussy in talking about it. I don't know what it is, but old man Herb, I think. I don't really think he wanted to go overseas. And young Herbie, it's the peacetime army,
oh,
and
yeah.
Doug was in the peacetime army. But Doug, he went to Egypt. He traveled all over. He was in Egypt for quite a while. They called them the peacetime army. When they were having all that trouble over there, so when they shipped them overseas, he was over there. And he did a lot of driving. See, that little jeep is not the actual jeep. He was in a bad car accident, got all smashed up. But that's the plaque that he won. He won the first prize in driving any kind of army equipment. He won the first prize because he was a good, safe driver. And when they were leaving over there at Gaza Strip, Egypt, when they were leaving over there, they gave him free passage to go all over Europe, four or five of those guys, for having good safe conduct, like, to, you know, being good guys, I guess. They traveled all over on their way back to Canada. So that was, you know, something good about being in it, I guess. He liked it. He liked the army life. And Herbie, I don't think he went anywhere across there. He was just in Ontario and Victoria. That's what happened with my Herbie boy. From Victoria, they used to go to Seattle on the long weekends, and he got to like Seattle. And those were the days when all the boys had gone to Vietnam, and you can get different jobs in Seattle, where he got a job as soon as he got out of the army, like. And he got a job on a construction, like, a heavy construction, building tunnel under the city, I think it was, near the airport somewhere. Anyways, they put him, so he used to be just a guy to oil the baby equipment and that. And they sent him to go on a course, on heavy equipment operator. So he was on that course for just about a year, and he was just ready to get a job when he got murdered. They murdered him. So he had little money in his car, somehow or another, through someone, they found out that he had a little money in his car. He went over there to trade his vehicle in on an old pickup that he was going to put a little house on the back, a little trailer of some sort, to live in, because they were sending him down to Alaska on the pipeline to build the pipe out there. They were getting ready to send him away when his life was taken there. He just went back across to trade his big car in. See, he had a big car, a big Ford car that used to be owned by the sheriffs over there. It had sirens and lights and everything, you know, those big high-focusing spotlights.
Uh-huh.
It had all that on his car still.
Oh, yeah.
And this is why they figured from the start these two darkies that did my son in, they figured the detective on the scene, I figured that they had, these two crooks had mistaken him for a sheriff or a private detective,
mm-hmm.
Because, you know, he was quite fair and quite husky, and he had this car, and they thought for sure that's what it was about. But then they found out when this guy turned the other crook in, that they took my son's life because they found out from someone he had little money stashed in the car. It wasn't very much, you know, but must have exaggerated to whoever did that. Anyways, you know, when he first got forced, he was forced out of a service station to what Bert said. They went to church, and as they're coming back from church, they were going by a bus depot, and Herbie asked this one man, where can they get gas that day? That's when gas was hard to be had. So they went down there, and Bert got out of the car, and he said that's the last he saw of Herbie. That these two crooks came along and forced Herbie out of there, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Forced him out of there and shot him quite a few blocks from there. What they had done is the one in the back was forcing the gun against his back as he's driving, and Herbie apparently felt this gun, and he says he looked in the rear view mirror and he says, oh my God, put that away or I'm going to jump out. So as he stopped to jump out, this car door had jammed. So the other crook that